Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, comedian and writer Lori Kilmartin and musician Adrian Underhill. Was the song Holding Out by Adrian Underhill off his debut album See You Again. I'll be speaking with Adrian a little later on in the show. But right now, my first guest is a comedian and writer who currently works as a staff writer for Conan, hosted by Conan O'Brien. As a comedian, she was a top 10 finalist in season 7 of Last Comic Standing and was listed in the Huffington Post's 53 Favorite Female Comedians in 2011. She has performed on Conan, Jimmy Kimmel Live, Premium Blend, Showtime, the USO Tour for Cuba, Shorties Watching Shorties, Verdict with Dan Abrahams, Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld, and The World's Stand Up. She's also appeared on VH1's Best Week Ever, The Today Show, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, The Rachel Maddow Show, Fox and Friends, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. She had a comedy special, 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad, which premiered on CISO in late December of 2016. She currently writes for Conan, but she's also written for The Late Late Show, Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, and Comedy Central's Too Late with Adam Carolla, as well as The Bonnie Hunt Show. She's also been published in The Huffington Post, Babbel.com, and co-authored Sherry Shepherd's memoir, Permission Slips. In 2012, she wrote her first book, which was the New York Times bestseller, Shitty Mom, The Parenting Guide for the Rest of Us. And earlier this month, she released her second memoir, Dead People Suck, A Guide for Survivors of the Newly Departed. She is Lori Kilmartin, and I spoke with her last week. Lori Kilmartin, hello, good morning, welcome. Thanks for being here so early.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So your book is Dead People Suck, A Guide for Survivors of the Newly Departed. Now I know sort of this book kind of came out of the death of your father. What made you want to tweet about that event in your life when your father was in his last moments?
Well, you know, he was doing home hospice, and so we were, I, my sister, my mom and I were just sort of hanging out at home with my dad. And, you know, you can't spend more than 15 seconds off your iPhone if you're a comedian, especially. So it was just a way to pass the time, honestly. I mean, when someone's dying, it's kind of boring sometimes, you know, they're tired. My dad was tired. He'd fall asleep. You know, obviously when he was talking and alert, I was 100% there with him. But, you know, when he was drifting off, I would sort of just drift away on my phone. I'd be hanging out with them, but it was just a way to pass the time and try to turn some crazy emotions into jokes. That was also just, it was almost like doing a crossword puzzle, you know?
Was he drifting off because he was watching too much Fox News at the end?
Sadly, that's the only thing that would keep him alert. yeah, I think it was more the cancer that was making him tired, but yeah, he did watch a little bit of Sean Hannity. We tried to pry the remote control from his cold, dying fingers, but were unable to.
Now, I heard that he passed on the day that the Oscars were. So, is this true that you sort of wrapped him up and he was there in the room with you while you and your sister watched that event?
Yeah, he died on a Sunday morning, and the Oscars were that night. And we decided to keep his body at the house overnight because he still looked alive, you know. It was just too difficult to part with him. And we thought, let's watch the Oscars with Dad. It would be kind of a funny, dumb send-off. He had no interest in the Oscars in life, and he still had no interest in death. But we all sort of were able to crowd onto his hospital bed and watch and joke and kind of get used to the fact that he wasn't alive anymore. And then the next morning, Monday morning, when we all woke up, you know, it was weird. My dad's body had changed overnight, obviously, and he really did look more like a corpse and not my dad. So it was easier for us to call, you know, the mortuary and say, come get him. You know, when someone's still pink, you don't want to have someone come and take them away from you.
You know, comedy and tragedy, I find, are two sides of the same coin. Why is it that so many artists and so many comedians use that, you know, those types of events in their life to fuel so much of their material and their work?
You know what? I think it kind of happens as you keep living. Like, I think when every comic starts, we're mostly talking about sex and dating and, you know, the little struggles. And when you look at it and then, you know, people that you love start to die, tragedy. As you live, of course, tragedy is going to start marking your life. And if you're a comic, you start going, oh, well, I guess I'm not talking about a date I had last night. I'm going to talk about, you know, my dad has cancer. Let's see if I can get some laughs out of this. And, you know, everyone in the audience is going to have that experience at some point. A lot of people already have, and you only have to worry about the ones that haven't, because they're the ones that are usually like, oh, how can you talk like that? It's like the people that have been through it are like, how can you not talk like that? How can you not joke about it?
You know, we all come to a point in our lives where we start thinking about our own deaths. You know, since your father's passing and given your line of work, is that something that you think about from time to time?
I think about it a lot because my mother moved in with me, and I'm seeing an elderly person sort of, you know, walk around the house. And I'm just doing practical stuff. Like, I took my bathtub out because I thought, you know, I don't want to fall in the shower and hit my head. And I see my mom like having to grab onto rails. So I'm actually trying to make my house a safer space for her and ultimately me one day. I definitely think I don't want to die because I fell on my bathroom. It fell on the tub. Like, I'd like to die some other way, not in the bathroom where I'm half naked and probably gross.
So even though you're a comedian, you wouldn't necessarily like to die in a funny or humorous way?
Well, maybe that would be a gift to my son, I guess, if I died in a funny way. No, I think most comedians are control freaks. Like, we're trying to control how people laugh at things, and we're trying to control our own emotions and how we process them in jokes and stuff. So I would like to control how I die, and hopefully it's at age 100 of a heart attack in the middle of the night. That's what I'm hoping for.
You know, on a more sensitive note, I know your son was there with you when your father passed, and he was only 7 at the time. So how do you, as a parent, how do you have that conversation with people?
I don't think he got it. I just think, you know, and it kind of sucks because he was just young enough where he kind of remembers my dad. My son's 11 now, and I know – I was his age when one of my grandparents died, and I just have a very slight memory of that grandparent. So I'm sad that my son has what I think is a slight memory of his grandfather. And I just try to bring him up I try to bring my grandpa up, his grandpa up all the time. And, you know, my son has an iPad that used to belong to my dad, and we still call it grandpa's iPad. So I label things that used to belong to my dad just so my son has them somewhat in his mind.
One of the chapter titles that I love was, if cancer was an STD, it would be cured by now. where do you think we are in terms of advances in medicine that are able to, if not cure, at least help us in some way with all these illnesses that we suffer later in life?
Well, there are probably a million more people more qualified to answer that than me. It seems, you know, like I feel like I just read something about lung cancer where I felt like, hey, that was my dad's kind of cancer. And if he'd have just gotten it a couple years later, he might have been able to manage it. It seems like that's happening a lot more, and people are living longer with cancer. They're not dying as quickly as they used to. But, you know, it's too late for my dad, so it kind of sucks that way. I, you know, there's probably people better able to answer how far we're getting medically, but it does irritate me that we're so good at making our lives, which are pretty easy now if you live in, you know, a first world country, making them easier, you know. And maybe some of the resources that we're going to make Amazon, making shopping, buying things easier, if they could just go to, you know, killing tumors, that would be great.
Why is, at least for you, why is laughter such a good medium or mechanism for coping and for dealing with grief?
Well, I guess it's been my way of coping for everything since I can remember. I do remember when I was in fourth grade, I wrote a story that was kind of funny, and I read it in front of my class, and this girl who was always mean to me laughed, and I remember feeling like, ha ha, I won. And even though she was still mean to me, she's like a bully, I was like, I got you, I made you laugh. And so it's almost like finding a vulnerability in somebody. I don't know that makes comedians sound generous as opposed to just, vindictive and angry about their childhood. But to me, that's always just been the way to go, is to try to get a laugh out of it.
Given that you were tweeting during this event, how do you find that social media has changed comedy, either as, maybe a way of looking at the world or interactions with fans?
It's given you an immediate outlet. It's strange. I can't. I really enjoy Twitter, which is. I wish I didn't, because then I would get off of it for a couple hours a day. There's a lot of jokes that aren't going to work on stage that work really well on Twitter. Those are fun to tweet. And sometimes you just can, work out some jokes for your act on Twitter. But I enjoy it. And I love following, my friends on Twitter that are so funny. That's probably a dumb answer. Sorry.
I know right now that you're working as a writer for Conan, and how would you compare your process writing jokes for somebody else versus writing jokes for yourself?
It's so different. They almost don't feel like the same skill. For Conan, it's mostly monologue jokes, so we're just dealing with the news, and the news cycle changes so quickly that, a joke you write on Monday morning, it's barely still relevant on Monday night half the time, because the way that Trump drops these news bombs like every 3 hours, it's hard to stay up with the news that way, because it changes so quickly. And how I write for my act is all based on things that happen to me in my personal life. So those jokes can take years to really finalize and develop,
Given sort of just how comically rich the president can be, to put it in a maybe diplomatic way, does that make it easier or harder as a comedy writer, given that it changes so quickly and there's always just so much happening?
I think it's harder. He's so you don't ever have to be diplomatic about Donald Trump. I apologize to what my country has inflicted on the world. He's so ridiculous that he's difficult to mock, I honestly miss the good old days of dumb George Bush or horny Bill Clinton. I mean, like they each had, great flaws, but they were flaws that were fun to exploit. And these flaws aren't. This guy's just a crazy psychopath. And, half the time you're writing jokes about it, and the other half you're like, is he going to start a nuclear war? And will, the show might air tonight, but will I be alive? I don't know.
How do you find the humor in something like that, in terms of it's funny, but we're also potentially fearing for our lives?
It's trickier. I'm telling you, it's trickier. And the other thing that makes it harder is there is Twitter, and there's so many funny people on Twitter that are responding immediately to something that, again, like you could write a great joke at 10 in the morning, and by the time we shoot the show at 4 in the afternoon, it's like, oh, it's been done, and someone else did it too. Or so you kind of have to, it's tough. I wonder, it makes me feel like the guys that used to write for Johnny Carson had it so easy. Like they were they were the only ones writing, the only ones telling jokes. Carson was the only one who was telling jokes that night. They had, everything was virgin snow to them, every topic. And by the time we get to every topic, it's been trampled.
Conan got a lot of kudos for going to Haiti. Jimmy Kimmel's been doing a lot of speaking out. John Oliver as well. It seems that in many ways, comedy has become almost the voice of the revolution, if you will. What is it about the late night talk shows that has maybe spurred society in a way the mainstream news can't.
Well, it just, I mean, if you just watch the mainstream news, I mean, they seem to be sticking to these very old rules from the 1950s of each side is equal and we have to treat, a pathological liar just like we treat Nelson Mandela. And he's like, no, they're not equals. And the fact that you're treating him that way makes the rest of us insane. And so we will say it if you won't. And I think a lot of people watching agree and get frustrated with the way the news treats this presidency and treated the primaries and the election as well.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, I came across the great article that you wrote for the New York Times about being a female comic in Louis C.K.'s world, and how much has that environment changed in the last 4 or 5 months since everything in Hollywood has started to explode?
I haven't seen huge changes in the last 4 or 5 months. I know that comics are talking about it more. I think we'll see changes more when the audience starts to change. Like, the audience always drives your material. And if you look at stand-up from 20 years ago or 10 years ago, the jokes that comics were getting away with, a lot of them wouldn't work now because the audience is changing. So I do think that's the thing we're all waiting for, and it's probably starting to trickle in slowly. But the things the audience laughs at are different now than they were 20 years ago. And I'm sure, next year it'll be a little bit different than it is this year. It's more changing the crowd and less the comic. If you look at comedy club lineups, they're still mostly dudes. And, it's not because most comics are guys. It's because most club owners are used to booking guys.
On that note, the last couple of years were sort of lamented by the fact that everyone, with social media, everyone is now getting offended by everything all the time. As a comic, do you feel that you have a duty to maybe push the envelope in terms of what you can get away with? Or do you have to play it more safe and cater to the audience that night and not offend them in certain regards?
I mostly try to get laughs with offensive material. That's kind of what I like to do. It's tricky, and sometimes I'll I have jokes that I'm like, all right, this is like the hardest joke of this chunk. And as I lead up to it, I'll sort of be taking the temperature of the audience. How much, are they still with me? Are they still with me? And if they are, I'll go all the way. And if they're not, maybe I'll back off because I don't want to have to dig myself out of a hole. Or maybe sometimes on the mood, okay, I'll dig myself out of a hole. I don't mind. It's more like how much energy I have, or if I feel like the audience is, sometimes the audience is willing to be mad at you and then they'll change their minds on the next joke. So to me, it's when I'm on stage, I sort of take the temperature of the crowd constantly. I'm always saying, is this 80% of the audience laughing at this joke, or 40% or 100%,
You stated that the last line in your obituary would be tip the wait staff. What would the first line in your obituary be?
Oh my God. hire my son. give him a job. His grades are great so far, so I'm a little worried.
does your son have any comic genes in him, do you think?
He does. He's funny. He has a little YouTube channel, and I watch it on the road when I miss him. He's funny. He makes me laugh a lot. He's sarcastic, and he does pratfalls and stuff. So, yeah, he's going to carry on the family tradition.
You've talked about perhaps writing your own obituary. Do you think that's what it's going to come to for people in general, that we're going to do it ourselves rather than let other people do it for us?
Everyone should write their own obituary, because why would you, your whole life, you're going to leave it in the hands of an amateur, of your cousin who's never written anything, of someone who doesn't know you very well, of a newspaper writer? you're the only one that knows your life. So I would say write your own obituary, update it every couple years. And that's a good way to look at your life and go, wow, am I accomplishing enough? have I done enough to have a good obituary? And, you know, this is like your final legacy. So I definitely say write it yourself. No one knows you better than you.
You've written a couple of books. Do you have any plans for something in the future? Maybe like a full-fledged biography or another little book of anecdotes?
I don't have anything planned right now, but I didn't plan Dead People Suck either. My dad died and I was like, whoa, okay, here we go. So hopefully, I hope I don't write another book because I don't want anything else awful to happen. So at the moment, I don't. Right now, I just want to start working, you know, just work on my act some more. And I'm as long as I can get up on stage every night, I'm still writing, whether it's books or jokes or whatever.
Any advice for budding comedians?
Get up on stage every single night for about 10 years. It really takes that long to develop your voice and to be comfortable on. You have to be comfortable thinking in front of people, you know, while they're watching you. And that takes a really, really long time. So just get up on stage every single night.
Well, the book is Dead People Suck, A Survivor's Guide for the Newly Departed. Lori Kilmartin, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers.
You too. Bye.
That was Lori Kilmartin. Her book, Dead People Suck, A Guide for Survivors of the Newly Departed, is out now. You can check her website at kilmartin.com, that's kilmartin.com, for club appearances and book signings. This is Adrian Underhill with Not Good Enough. And that was Not Good Enough, which is the single off of See You Again, the debut album by Toronto-based electronic musician Adrian Underhill. And on this album, Adrian actually gets to work with a producer named Kindness, who has worked with some names you may have heard of in the past, Blood Orange, Solange, and Robin, among others, and is described as a smoldering electro soul. It's a very, very good balance between lush sounds and the spare, quiet musings of lo-fi. I had a chance to speak with Adrian a few weeks back, just prior to his show at the Drake Hotel at the beginning of the month. And we got to talking about the album, about everything that goes into the music making process and the debut. So this is my conversation with Adrian Underhill. Adrian Underhill, hello, welcome. How's it going today?
It's going well, thank you.
So this is your—they're saying this is your debut EP, LP. How does it feel to have it finally out there?
Yeah, it feels really good. it's been kind of like, you know, about 3-4 years working on these tunes, like from like demos to like figuring out how to make the record and like who to make it with, and then doing that process. And yeah, it's been like, you know, just a crazy learning experience, like doing my first record. And so I'm just excited for people to hear it, and yeah, to just kind of like roll that momentum into whatever comes next.
You know, given how long you've been working on some of these songs, how close is the sound that we hear on the record to what you had initially envisioned? How much did it morph over time?
Yeah, it morphed a lot. And like most of that happened in a pretty condensed period. I worked on this whole record with a guy named Adam Bainbridge, who's project, his artist project is Kindness, and I worked on these demos for a really long time. We kind of started chatting and sending emails and stuff, but then we put aside like 5 weeks where we basically sat and reworked my demos and started from there and kind of like almost like remixed them into different versions of themselves. And then after doing that for a little bit, we went to LA and we involved like 3 like really amazing studio musicians, and we got them to play on top of it. And then we kind of went back to Montreal and finished it. Took all the kind of like creative madness that had been happening and kind of like played editor a little bit and was like, okay, this is good, this is good, let's throw away this, this is good. And so that kind of gave it a unifying sound, I think, having that, like, even though it was like a long process, having a shorter period of time where you're really like tweaking the sounds, I think it comes out sounding cohesive.
The relationship between artists and producers, you know, many artists that I've talked to, especially when they're making their first, will often self-produced and then they'll get discovered after that, but you're working with the producer right off the bat. What was that relationship like in terms of, you know, maybe you wanting this or him saying, well, let's try this and see how it works? What mm-hmm. was that dynamic like?
Well, it was cool. I mean, like I do a lot of like recording myself, and a lot of my original demos like made it into the final versions of the songs in places, but what I was really craving was just like having some collaboration on this record and having, like, bringing in more influences than just what's in my head, you know, being a solo project. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to do with this record, was just to open it up a little bit once the songs were finished. And what the one thing that really, like, stayed the same was, like, the songs and the structures of the songs, like, pretty much didn't change at all from the way I had written them. But what changed was just the sounds, like the sonic palette, like what drum sounds we're using, what the patterns were like, and yeah, and the kind of choices of production wise were the things that we kind of just, like, played with until it seemed cool.
Just from a creative and an artistic standpoint, how important is it? I mean, you can speak journalist experiences, but as you know, as a musician, sort of, you know, in just as a whole, as an artist, how important is it to bring in that outside person, to bring in you know, either a producer or perhaps a co-writer for one song to help that process along?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but for me it was really helpful, and especially, like, I learned a lot from everybody who became involved in the record, and I'm really thankful for that, and I want to keep doing that. Like, you know, you pick up from different people, different techniques and different ways of listening and different, you know, different styles. Like, there's like styles of music that are on this record that I wouldn't have put in there by myself, that sound, like, really cool in the final versions. And so for me, it was just, like, all positive to have more ideas. And then, you know, of course, you still have that process at the end where you can be like, eh, maybe this doesn't work. Or you can still make those executive decisions at the end. But to draw from a bigger pool of creativity was, like, just fun.
Electro type music, however you want to classify that, is that seems to be one genre that is, you know, that we didn't really know much about 10, 15 years ago, and is now everywhere. Some musicians say it's a good thing, others maybe aren't so sold. Where are you in terms of how we are using technology to further creativity?
I mean, I think I played a show last night in Montreal with my friend Mindbath, who sang on the record as well, and he was saying something during his set to the effect of, like, people, you know, sometimes get down on, criticize people who are using laptops to make music. And I think at the heart of it, it's just, like, people use what tools they have available to them to make music, and that's great. Like, that's what people should do. There's no right way to do it. And I think I'm obviously interested in a lot of newer influences as well as older ones, but, like, I think new technology is exciting, and there's for me, it's interesting to see the collage, like, pulling from lots of different places and trying to fit it together, a bit of new, a bit of old. Yeah.
You know, with you know, nobody buying CDs anymore, people not even really buying MP3s to the same extent that they were, how the process of selling yourself, basically marketing yourself as an artist, getting your name out there, connecting with fans, what's that journey and learning process been like for you?
Well, in a way, it's sort of starting now. You know, my record comes out tomorrow, and, you know, I've learned a lot about the recording process and getting the out, like, the creative thing finished, and now I'm kind of, like, entering into, you know, how to give it to people and how to get the music to listeners. So, you know, it's something I'm going to learn about a lot, I think, over the next year, and I'm excited about that.
How would you describe your overall writing process when you're crafting a song, especially since you're the type of artist that works with a lot of sort of sound and layered background elements rather than just lyrics in a guitar or lyrics in a piano?
Yeah, I mean, most of these songs did start in a sort of simple way with just like one drum pattern and like maybe a loop or something, and me sitting at the keyboard and just improvising chords and improvising melody and slowly getting to a structure and a song. And yeah, that was a process that I think really worked for me, was to have a song that kind of stand on its own. I could sit at a piano and play most of these songs, not all of them, but most of them. And then to kind of go from there and look at the production process as a kind of separate entity where you're, you know, playing with sounds and you're not so much doing the songwriting anymore. You have a song that you're happy with. That's really important, like, to have as a starting point. And then you can kind of have fun with what should this sound like sonically.
What kind of conversations go into that? Given that it is such a, you know, sound heavy album, the process of sort of determining what layers would sound good together, what sort of, you know, sonic qualities would mesh well.
Yeah, I think it's just play. You play. You play and you bring in people and you know just. Sometimes you just let people like go wild and follow their own ideas about what they hear on top of the tracks you've already created, and you need to have that like period where you're just kind of open to anything, and then you can kind of, you know, make harder decisions later. But that's the only way I've, you know, known what the sound of a song should be, is just by playing with it until you feel like you're getting somewhere.
The first single is
all good.
Yeah, I left your phone in the car. I realized.
Oh, okay. I can get it.
The first single.
What?
I can get it afterwards.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm gonna use the bathroom.
Okay. Thanks.
The first single is Not Good Enough.
Yeah.
How did sort of that track become that track?
Yeah, I mean, thematically, I think it just kind of like percolated slowly. It wasn't so much one of those songs you could say stems from one specific experience. It was just, you know, I was kind of like digging around in my brain for things to write about that felt important to say, and that, you know, felt like they might, there might be someone out there who would want to hear what's being written. And it's hard to really say much more than that, you know. An idea comes to you and that's it.
Choosing a single is always an interesting conversation, but especially for your first album, because it's your introduction as an artist. It's your representation.
Totally.
How did you go about, you know, you and Adam go about deciding, okay, maybe this is the song that we should go with to start off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like after everything was finished, we started thinking about that, and I thought that song, you know, was sort of unique in some ways in its subject matter, and unique maybe in the sense that it's a pretty vulnerable song. And I thought that was like an interesting way to like enter the music space, was, yeah, by like sharing some of my own vulnerability and maybe like leaving a space for someone to see themselves in that or to relate to that in some way. Something about that idea of how it would be received seemed interesting. seemed worthwhile and a possibly good starting place.
The sort of the universality of that specific theme, because I think we've all felt vulnerable at a certain time of your lives. How does something, you know, like that, you know, sadness, overwhelming sadness, the ability of artists to maybe channel that and turn it into something positive, if you will, or at least, you know, an acceptance of that reality. Is that a factor for you at all for this song in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to leave space for both, you know, like it's open ended, and it's like, you know, there's bad thoughts swimming around in everybody's head, and that's kind of like the starting point. But there's also this, you know, that maybe that the idea is maybe that creates an opening for us to understand each other better and to relate to one another better, because we're all having some of those thoughts. So for me, it was kind of about having a bit of the optimism and the, you know, honest look at something that could be depressing, and having both of those exist in a song and leaving it up to the listener to kind of hear it how from where they are at.
Would you say you have a favorite song off of See You Later?
See You Again.
See You Again.
I don't know. I think I don't really have a favorite song, but one of the songs that was cool for me was How to Make a Life Count, because that song had one of the more dramatic transitions from demo to finished version. It was a very chill demo, and the lyrics seemed important to me, but, you know, it was hard to tell whether it was exciting enough from a musical standpoint. But the thing that really ended up being amazing for that song was getting the live players playing on top of it, and just like turning it into a live song made it really exciting and kind of surprised me with where it ended up.
Well, the album is See You Again, and it's on tomorrow, February 9th.
Yeah.
Adrian Underhill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Adrian Underhill. His album, See You Again, that's See You Again, is out now, and also Laurie Kilmartin's book, Why Dead People Suck, A Guide for Survivors of the Newly Departed, is out as well. Be sure to stream or download the show on Friday. It's going to be big. It is my annual Oscars show. And as problematic as the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences can be, I've always enjoyed the movies, and I always try to sort of interview nominees that aren't necessarily right in the mainstream. And this year I've got Ziad Doueri, who is the director of The Insult, which is Lebanon's entry for Best Foreign Language Film, as well as Agnès Varda, who is the co-director of the documentary Faces Places, which is the favorite to win. She co-directed that along with JR, and as well she received an honorary Oscar at the Governor's Awards in November. And then next week, on the 9th, I'm doing a special on the Canadian Screen Awards, as the nominees have been announced for that. And so far I've interviewed Nabil Rao and Jamil French, who were both nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor, respectively. So stay tuned for that. And upcoming guests also include Jeff Lemire, Shannon Fresco, and Paul McKenzie of The Real McKenzies. So it's going to be shaping up to be a good couple weeks. Going to take you out with Adrian Underhill's song, How to Make a Life Count. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now. We'll be right back.